Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for them.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I gave it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
No yelling on the bus.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight familiar, your butt at the party.
And Jake Latondras.
I am bad news.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet this guy's into the woods $100.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, didn't say it.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
Showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur in the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi. Joining me on his way home from work on this Wednesday night, Spence,
that's
our podcast with Josh, man. Good Lord at the numbers.
Really? That's funny.
Oh, man.
Cool.
I know a lot of people are picking on Josh about. And usually, I go back through and I try to edit a lot of us out. I've actually now, I can tell on the sound graph where an is.
Really?
I know a lot of people are giving Josh a hard time about saying And I just went through, finagled with the sound a little bit and uploaded it. I had to get to the vet clinic. But I know a lot of people giving Josh a hard time about saying But overall, everything that I've seen or heard sent to me, that podcast is great.
Good deal. Well, there's a lot to be said. I know I kind of preached about it at the end there, but there's a lot to be said for how Josh killed that bird and how he just stayed true to, you know, his own ways and his own rules his own rules he made for himself and rules of engagement, I guess you'd call them. And I think a lot of Josh, he's that kind of a person. He's definitely a man of principle like that. He's a good friend for a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons is because he definitely is one of those people that encourages and inspires me to live my own life that way, you know. It's just so easy to bend the rules and do, you know, when nobody's looking, you know, and that's what your character is what you do when nobody's looking.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Hey, let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get more tired during turkey season if you hunt consistent days in a row versus duck season?
No. I get way more tired during duck season. I mean, I get tired during turkey season too, but I didn't hunt as much like this past year, but I mean, a normal duck season for me is leave the house about 2 a.m., you know, and drive 3 hours, be somewhere at 5, hunt till 9:30, 10 o'clock, drive back 3 hours, take a shower at the office, and work until 6 or 7 or, you know, whatever. Work not quite a full 8-hour day, but, I mean, that's kind of my grind during duck season. Go home, fall straight to sleep. And during turkey season, I mean, most of the places that I have to hunt, like day in, day out, are within an hour drive of the house. And, you know, it doesn't get light right now till, fly down's about 6:30-ish, depending on clouds. And so, I mean, heck, I can wake up at 4 and leave my house at 4:30 or 4:45, and I could be 45 minutes before fly down most everywhere that I like to hunt. So that's a pretty big difference, you know. And then I can get to the office sooner because I don't have 3 hours back to the office and get home sooner and to bed sooner. And turkey season is not nearly the drain on me that duck season is. Turkey season is like recharge, man.
The long term haul of duck season is killer. When you hunt, right. You literally outside of Christmas Day, about 50 days in a row, like I did for a long, long time. You know, let me explain this to people. About the first week, it's tough. And you got a 3 or 4 week transition period in there, so that's 35 days. In that last 15 days, you're just about like a zombie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't get enough sleep. I mean, you hunt, and then you lay down, take a nap, and sleep till dinner, and wake up, eat dinner, and go back to sleep, and it doesn't, 12, 14 hours sleep just doesn't recharge you.
No.
But I don't
took
get like
a whole
that.
Two or three days.
Yeah, I mean, recharge. I get tired during turkey season, but I don't get tired like that.
Maybe it's just
I'm bad
in one day that you do.
Probably two, but also I'm bad about for turkey hunting. I'm bad about I'll sleep in and not hunt if it looks like the weather's going to be sketchy. And or if it looks like there's going to be a couple pretty days, I might hunt a little bit longer, And I also like right now, I mean, I know that next week, I have not been hunting in Mississippi because I know that the first 2 weeks of April, I'm going to be traveling, and I've got a couple pretty solid things lined up to hunt where I can hunt kind of all day, and so. Like right now, I'm kind of knocking out some work instead of starting the everyday grind. So I end up kind of doing it in spurts. I'll hunt every day for a little bit, and then I'll kind of work every day for a little bit. And when I work, I get better sleep. I get a good 9-10 hours, and but I don't know.
Man, when you get into zombie mode, though. During duck season, you really have to talk to yourself in your mind to say, okay, you got to control what comes out of your mouth. Because, man, I don't know about everybody else, because there's some weird crap that comes out of my mouth when I'm in zombie mode during duck season.
Yeah. That and man, for me, I tend to, it's not depression, but it's like a mental fog that settles in and you think the world's always going to be like life sucks. The world's always going to be like this. And I mean, one of my favorite quotes for all of life from my dad, he told me one time in seminary, you pulled a couple all-nighters and been up for 3 or 4 days trying to write papers and all that. And he was like, man, you need to just go home and go to bed, get you some sleep. And I said, I know. And he was like, no, really? He was like, sometimes you just need to eat a big meal, poop real big, take a shower afterwards, and go to sleep for about 12 or 14 hours. I started laughing. He said, I'm serious. He said, a good old dump and a shower and a good night's sleep will change the way you look at the world. And he's right. It does.
Man, there's days when you're like that, though. You can drive 40 or 50 miles, and you're sitting there wondering how you got there.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
I hope I didn't run any red lights.
A couple years ago, one of the stories that my buddies tell about me, unfortunately, and I'm not proud of this, but I hit a parked car on the way to Arkansas in Black Betty. One time, I mean, I was rolling, 80 miles an hour around the interstate loop, and it kind of iced over. It was one of those where it kind of rained and a little bit of snow, and then it iced over that night, and so they were calling off school and were, you know, people were not going to work and all that kind of crap. And of course, I'm 2:30 in the morning, just full steam ahead, rolling to Arkansas. And I came around the new flyover at 2:40 and 40 in Memphis. And I got kind of on the back side of it on the downhill, sweeping to the right curve there. And I kind of got a little wiggly in Black Betty, and I sideswiped this parked car. And I mean, how I didn't die, I don't know. I just barely, all it did was it ripped off the plastic wheel well fender on the front driver's side tire, and it tore the sidewall rubber off the tire and flatted my tire. And so I pulled over on the side of the interstate and changed my tire and kept on rolling.
So do you leave a note? Do you call the police?
By the time I realized what happened, I mean, I was in a fog. I was in such a fog that it scared me. I hit the car and didn't know what I hit. And I mean, it was a mile before I could kind of regain mental and physical composure of what was going on. And at that point, then I was like, dadgum. And then it kind of hit me like, what if there was somebody standing there like pouring gas in their tank or trying to flag me down? I mean, I was just that out of it and kind of fogged and turned the flashlight on my cell phone, started looking for blood, make sure I didn't kill somebody. Called my buddies and said, I'm going to be about 15 minutes late. Y'all go on.
I kind of compare it to a marathon, though, and we'll get into the story in just a second. But like I said, you start off fast. There's about a four-week period there that you get your second win. And, man, there's 2 or 3 weeks, 14 to, you know, 21 days that your legs feel like they're about to fall out from under you. And it's rough. It is rough.
No doubt.
All right, so
no doubt.
Last week, you know, when we ended it, I said that we were going to talk about that. There came a point in you making these calls that, man, you got to start making a lot more calls. So what was
right.
that process? Where did you take that to? Because I know the you duck call man, he wasn't mass producing a ton of calls every day.
He was doing it pretty good. And he did it, and he made them up until, we're in 2019 now. He made them up to probably 2015, something like that. And the first thing we did was we improved our packaging. So, we eliminated a lot of time by streamlining our packaging and getting something that was a lot easier to deal with. The second thing that we did was... I got a different kind of reed punch built so that I wasn't having to, my reeds were kind of coming out more uniform, and reeds was a problem because when we started, nobody was, when I started selling the Rolling Thunders, Kirk McCullough was not making cutdowns. Nobody else was making a cutdown except for Michael Fleeman and Black Ops. And so getting reeds was a problem. So like old reeds in Mylar was a problem because most of the olds were the black vinyl stuff. And that stuff sounded fine, but you just couldn't get your hands on it. So to get 14 mil, reed material was you could get the material, but getting it cut out like an old and getting it curved at the front was a big deal. I mean, and it was almost, I don't know exactly when Rich and Tone got their R&T guys got their punch made, but for the first pretty good while, if you look back or you ask Jimbo, I mean, Jimbo got a pair of curved scissors and he was putting the curve on the front of those reeds with scissors. And so, one of the first things that I did was I got this punch built I got two or three different ones built and we kind of experimented with them until we got one that worked right. But 14 mil Mylar is different than 10 mil. I mean, obviously because it's thicker, but it's it's 14 mil Mylar is two layers of material that are basically laminated together, whereas 10 mil Mylar is more like one layer-ish. It doesn't, 10 mil will split and it'll bubble, but it doesn't split the same way that 14 mil Mylar does. 14 mil Mylar will split and it'll be like two flat layers. Like it'll split down the middle. And so you can stick your finger in there and you can peel it back. It looks like a, you know, like, two identical pieces of Mylar. If you blow that reed enough. So I guess I'm telling you that because you couldn't go to a normal tool and die guy and get a punch that an arbor press hit with a blade. We had to get this punch made that went through the material. Different than that, you had to hold the bottom of the material when you hit it from the top so that it didn't fracture it. Because normally, like a tool and die guy would have a blade on top and some sort of a rubber surface underneath that kind of cushioned, took the blow of the blade and didn't dull the blade. But if you do that with 14 mil reed material, it would fracture, delaminate the entire exterior perimeter of the reed. And so your reed was ruined from moment number one. So we went through a bunch of different steps to kind of get that dialed in. And Dave Jackson was making the Grafton cut down, and he had some reeds, and he had a punch, but I didn't know him straightway, and he kind of didn't have his – I mean, he was selling the Grafton call and sort of a cut down, but I guess just by being in Illinois, he was a little bit out of the Arkansas scene, and that's kind of where the cut down stuff was happening. So we streamlined our packaging. And we got a better reed punch made. Those two things right there saved us just a tremendous amount of time on a per call basis. I guess that.
How did you change the packaging? Real quick. What'd you do?
So we went from the first packaging was a tube, and it had a paper insert in it that was
right.
Basically, it looked like a rectangle. The paper did . But we had to cut it out with scissors and then glue it together into like a cylinder, and then we dropped it down in the tube. And
just
took so long that we went to a clamshell and then a single card. And so we just had, you know, I got the cards printed. I'd have 1,000 cards sitting there, and I just, you know, you put them in the back of the clamshell. It went from a whole bunch of labor and packaging to like 2 seconds in packaging. And my kids could do that, you know, and then the other so packaging, streamlining the reed punch, that was huge. And the other reason that was huge is because people were just constantly asking me for reeds. You know, I'd have guys that would send me a message and they'd want to buy reeds, and you couldn't sell a reed for enough. I mean, you know, people would want 50 or 100, and then you'd stand out there and you'd try to come up, cut the reeds different ways. You know, once we had the punch, then I could start selling them. And for a while, Dave Jackson went through a divorce and he had to shut down his call company. And so for a couple of years, I sold old replacement reeds to Max. I was the only source of cut down reeds, and I sold them to Kirk McCullough for a year or two. And so there was like, there was a period in there where I probably sold 30,000, you know, old reeds and we had
Holy
to punch those
crap.
one at a time with a baby sledge. I mean, you just tunk, you know, and tunk and tunk, just kind of kept hitting that thing because it couldn't go through an arbor press. It couldn't, you know, I mean, it, like the way the punch that I had fashioned, that was just how you had to do it. And there's a half a dozen people or more. I could rattle off some names, and if you'd laugh, of people who literally would come to the house and just help us. And so kind of for a few years there, before I tell that next part, we streamlined packaging.
Before you leave it, what year was all, you know, that all these changes were made?
Belt?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm lumping all this in. It happened over time. I guess we changed the packaging straight away. You know, by that first spring, I realized I had to have a clamshell. The tubes weren't going to work. They were a pain in the butt. They looked cool, but they didn't take up enough space on the shelf. And so, maybe the first 8-9 months after we were started, I started with clamshells. And then the reed punch probably came that first fall. It didn't take too long to get the reed punch. I realized I ordered two or three different kinds of reed punches pretty much straight away. But I finally kind of got my punch dialed in, I guess, maybe a year after we started. So that would have been like 2011. But the next big thing that we did, because remember when the barrels came off of, out of the mold, there were four places you had to take a razor knife and cut off the slag material.
That's right.
And then you had to chuck it into the lathe and sand down the mouthpiece and sand down the other end of the barrel where the insert went into it. And so the history of the mold would be that the very first mold that we had built, I can't remember if I told this or not, but the very first mold we had built, the U Duck Hall man guy didn't understand how to make the insert stay in the barrel. And so when you put an insert in a barrel, you can't just go from, the barrel can't be 0.625 or 5/8 inside diameter and the insert be 5/8 diameter, because that doesn't go together. They have to be, you know, one has to be smaller than the other, or one has to be bigger than the other, right? Well, you don't know that until you try to build a duck call and somebody tells you that. You think, well, a duck call barrel is 5/8. That's what five eighths bore. That's what everybody's duck call barrel is, and so every custom call maker drills out their barrels with a 5/8 drill bit. Well, so until you try it, you would think that you want your insert to be 5/8 as well, but it doesn't work that way. Your insert's got to be a little bit less than 5/8. So, but then about there's a section of your call that has to have a friction fit. So you got to put the insert in the barrel and it be not too tight to go in there, but not too loose that the connection is only like, the surface area of the connection is only like 1/8 of an inch. And I didn't know that. And nor did Dr. Shea. So he built a mold with an insert, and they got quickly named the Barrel Busters is what we nicknamed them, because the insert that where it connected into the barrel, the insert, I mean, it had like a 45-degree angle on it. And so it was more built like a plug for a hole than it was an insert that's supposed to stick into a duck call barrel. And so almost immediately from day one, we came out with this marketing video of me driving over a duck call with a pickup truck, and it was sturdy enough to go take a pickup truck, but if you really crammed the insert into the barrel, you could split the barrel because of the slope of the connection on the insert. I don't know if that makes any sense. You'd have to see a picture of it, but basically the insert acted like,
yes,
it acted like a wedge. It acted like a wedge. If you were trying to split wood, you split a big log, you hit it with a maul, and then you put a wedge in there, and then you take your sledgehammer and you drive that wedge down in it until the wood starts to split. Well, that's what the insert was doing to the barrel. So straightway, I mean, like 4 months in, we had to build a new insert mold that had a better connect, that made us an insert that connected better in the barrel. So, and to his credit, I will say, Mr. Butch is the one who showed me how to do that. The first insert that I had obviously didn't work, but the second one I had didn't work either. And the reason it didn't work is because the the length of material on the insert that engaged with the barrel was not long enough. And he showed me, I'll never forget, we were sitting in Little Rock, actually, in Conway, and he pulled out a call, and he showed me, he drew a line on it, and he said, your insert, when you stick it in there, shouldn't touch the sidewalls of the barrel until it gets to right here. And he drew a line on it with a Sharpie. And then he stuck it in another about 3/4 of an inch or an inch, and said, you know, from that line to right here, you should be touching the call the whole way. And the further the distance on the backside of that tone board that it's making contact when you're pushing it in the barrel, the better the friction fit is. And he looked at me and he said, all these new call makers want to make their calls with an O-ring. And he said, I'm going to tell you why they do it. He said, it's because they don't know how to make a friction fit that works. And I sat there and I looked at him, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know how to make a friction fit that works. and he said, you watch. He said the mark of a good call maker is not only does the call sound good, but he said, a guy who knows how to make a friction fit on a lathe really knows what he's doing. There's an art to that. It's kind of like in woodworking, you know, one of the hardest things to make is a box, a perfectly square box. Well, it's the same way in duck calls. Like, making a friction fit insert into a barrel there's an art form to it. And I'd have never gotten that right without his help. He really, really helped me there. So new packaging, new reed punch, but right along with it, we got a new insert mold made that, connected into the barrel better. And when we did that, we used some of the things that we learned about making the mold meet up together. So left side, right side of the mold as two cavities. And we learned how to make the mold meet up. And if the mold meets up more perfectly, the left side to the right side, you have less slag material that you have to cut and trim and sand off. So by having been, you know, just in the good Lord's providence, having to remake the insert mold because of the problems with the insert sticking into the barrel, we had to make a new insert because of that problem. We were able to make a new insert and make a better insert that took less labor to tune and to cut the slag material off and kind of, you know, all those things. And then I guess the next step that we did that really changed things a lot was, we took our barrel mold and used what we learned from the insert mold and making the two cavities line up. There's some tricks to that. What we learned from the new insert mold, we applied that to the barrel mold and reduced a lot of the slag material that we had to cut and sand. And then the next big step to the barrel mold was we spent some money and had it polished, the inside of it polished. And when we did that, it really cleaned up some of the parts. And you'd never be able to tell if you looked at the multiple parts because we would do so much sanding and stuff after the fact to make them all look the same. But what it did was it eliminated so much of the human labor that it took to have a, you know, a call that we can sell. I'm about to go through a valley. I might cut out for just a second.
Okay. I just pulled up your YouTube video of running over the call. Why are you telling that? Man, you were a young man. You don't even look like you.
I mean, it's been almost 10 years. I mean, I had a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old in that video.
for those of you that are listening to this, go, when you get a chance on YouTube, look up BSOD, Black Stick of Death, Duck Call Truck Test. I don't know how that thing didn't go viral.
I mean, I don't know. There's just you know, not that many people interested in it. It was a niche thing, man. You know, I mean, it wasn't.
I'm saying just in the community of duck hunters. I mean, running over a duck call on concrete.
It got a lot of views, and actually, the first one did kind of blow up. But when we first started, and when I posted that video, my YouTube channel was called Black Stick of Death, because before we started, I thought that was going to be the name of the call company, and then I realized real quick, like before we really even started selling them, remember I had to decide the difference between the name of the call and the call company, and so we decided to separate them. Well, I had already made the YouTube channel, and I'd called it Black Stick of Death, so I had to like delete that YouTube channel and then repost that video, you know, 6, 8, 10 months down the road, and so a lot of the original views are not there. That's like a reposting of the original video. But did you
ever think that Rolling Thunder was going to have a hard time catching on? It just rolls off. It does.
But man, I always thought Rolling Thunder I always thought that was a really cool name. I thought it was a lot cooler than BSOD. I don't know why. I mean, I just thought there was a ton you could do with that marketing-wise, you know. I mean, the possibilities were endless, in my view, you know. I mean, it just seemed like you could...
No, I agree. I agree with you.
And it was original, and it was different than everybody else, you know, and it kind of, like, it resonated. It just... So I guess those are kind of the main things that we did. The next big thing that we did that really kind of unlocked the product line for us was we had to figure out how do you make more than one cut down, and one of the cult following sort of cut down things that cut down guys do, and you'll see it now that I say it to you, is they have like a single drop lanyard with one call on it. So cut down guys are not like your Midwestern Yankee goose goobers that have, you know, 27 calls and, you know, 5,000 bands and 2 whistles, and, you know, you'll never see a guy that spends his winter in the Arkansas timber with like a cut down and a pintail whistle or a cut down and a Drake whistle. I mean, you just don't see that. Like a guy that's got a whistle on his lanyard's got a J frame and a goose call, and he's got 10 other calls on his lanyard. And so some of these stores, I was feeling some pressure from some of these stores to come out with new products and kind of stay ahead of the curve. But at the same time, I kind of deep down in my heart, I was like, I mean, I just made the best duck call that's ever been made. It's louder than everything on the market. You can run over it with the dang pickup truck. It's got a lifetime guarantee. It's made in the United States of America right here in Millington, Tennessee, in my shop. I mean, why would you want another call? And so there was like this tension between create new products and just say to the world, hey, this is the only duck call you need. and I got to admit, I mean, I struggled with that because I thought one duck call was good enough. I wore 2 cut downs on my lanyard, but they were exactly the same. And it was just because I was afraid I might break one of them. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so we kind of started fiddling with it, and I met a guy named Tyler Rogers and he lives down in South Arkansas, and he knew a lot of history and just kind of became a fast friend, and a lot of his buddies blew a call that had a blunt tip on it instead of having a rounded tip on the end of the tone board. It had a more of a blunt tip, kind of a 45-ish degree angle. And some people call that a Louisiana cut. It's not exactly fair to call it a Louisiana cut, but that kind of caught on, and it's stayed that way. And you can't, you know, there's no reason in debating it now. But so I started experimenting with that, and what I did was I just took some of the original cut tone boards that we were getting molded, and I would just chop off the end of them or put them on a belt sander and just put a blunt end on them, and it changed the sound a good bit. I mean, not just a ton, but it made it a little raspier, a little barkier, a little more rattle in it, and just kind of, it accommodated some people a little better. And so we decided, well, you know, since it's got a 45 degree angle, heck, we'll call it, one of Tyler's friends called it an Olt 45, OLT, you know, like a Olt with a 45 degree angle on it. And so I called him one day and I said, do you mind if I steal that name? And I'm going to call it a Colt 45, like the pistol or, you know, the ammo, whatever. And he said, yeah, go for it. And so I kind of got it dialed in like I liked it. And so now I got a new model. And at the same time, I also started experimenting with a set of molded guts that another call maker friend gave me, and putting a thinner reed in it, because the number one thing that people would say about a cut down was that it was too hard to blow. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to make something different, how do I not undermine what I think is my best product? And so I tried really hard to add an additional product or two that complemented what I was doing, but didn't do the same thing. They were truly different and met a different need. And so,
Hey, but before you go into that, tell the people that don't blow a cut down, I mean, why it's so much harder to blow a cut down. Reed's a little bit more stiffer, a little bit thicker.
Yeah. So your reed is 40% thicker, right? It's 14 millimeters instead of 10 millimeters thick, a J frame is. But it's also, so that's one reason, is the reed's thicker. So it's heavier. You got to push more air to get it to lift up and bend and make a quack. But the other reason that it's harder to blow is because the reed is a lot longer. It's not quite twice as long, but it's probably, I don't know, I hadn't looked at it in a long time, just guess, it's probably 30% or more longer. And if it's longer, then it's, and thicker, then it's just a lot heavier, takes a lot more air to push under. And then the third reason that it's harder to blow is because there's the hole in the exhaust. The exhaust is short and the hole is big, which takes a lot of the back pressure out of it. Right. It's just wide open. And then the fourth reason is the barrel is long. And some people will tell you, a lot of people on duck call pages that will say things like, well, barrels don't matter. The length of the barrel doesn't matter, or the barrel material doesn't matter, all this thing. And that's just absolute horse crap. Barrels, the barrel matters almost as much as the insert. I mean, it's a big deal. Just that's why the Brute is so popular. It's why the Mondo LT is so popular, or whatever they call the Mondo with the shorter barrel. I mean, it's popular because that shorter barrel builds the sound it's a smaller sound chamber, and so you have to build less pressure in the air. It all works together. It just makes the call a little more user friendly. So the old Olts just are a wide open, no back pressure, long thick reed, long barrel. You know, I mean, and they're not impossible to blow. It's just, it's kind of like blowing a short reed goose call. You know, it's just, if you grew up blowing an old Falk's long reed goose call and you pick up a short reed goose call, I mean, you're just helpless because you're building so much back pressure with your hand and your throat. It's just a different, it's just a totally different game. Okay. So I set out to make these two new products, and we called one the Easy Bark and one the Colt 45. And the idea behind the Easy Bark was, if I'm going to make a call that's different than the original cut down, what do people want? And what people wanted was something that looked like a cut down, kind of sounded like a cut down, but was easier to blow. And so we called it the Easy Bark. It was probably the most popular call we sold. Sold the absolute snot out of them.
Wow. And it had that's a what molded, I was going to ask.
Had a molded gut system. I to this day, I still get asked for them all the time. And I quit making them for a couple reasons. But we'll go into that at another time. But we sold them for probably 5-ish years or so. I don't remember when we stopped selling the Easy Bark, but the Easy Bark was really popular. And so now I've got three models, but I had to figure out how do I differentiate the models, but still make them look the same. Because I believed, remember one of the things I said early on was I believed that the power behind a cut down was that most duck hunters envision themselves in their ideal scenario when they close their eyes, you know, and they dream of duck hunting. They dream of it in the flooded woods. You know, they dream of a timber hunt. That's what everybody wants to do. And so I felt like the power behind my call line was I had to make a call that looked like a cut down because people wanted something on their lanyard that looked like, hey, I'm a, you know, like a cut down guy was like the most pure form of a duck hunter in the woods. And so that's sort of the image that, I mean, I don't want to say the image we portrayed like we were faking something because we weren't faking it, but that was the image we were trying to perpetuate in the call line. And so while I had three different models, I wanted them all to kind of look the same. I didn't want to make them look like a regular J frame. I wanted them to look like a cut down. And so we had to figure out how do we make this black cut down, this black call, they're all three different. How do you tell the difference between them? And man, we racked our brain and thought about laser engraving and thought about this, thought about that. And ultimately what we came up with was my partner, Wes, he had the idea. He said, you know, if you take material away from a mold, it makes the part larger, right? So just imagine for just a second if you were trying to make an injection mold, a cavity for a cylinder, a perfect cylinder, and you wanted to make, if you took material away from the inside of the mold, it would make the cylinder larger, the actual molded part, right? So,
right.
So Wes had this idea that if we took the existing mold, remember we had just, you know, we just rebuilt the insert mold to make the insert connect into the barrel better. And that was not cheap, even though they were doing it for us kind of, you know, on the cheap. We had to buy a slab of aluminum for them to machine. And they actually, I didn't say this, but they actually messed up the first one. So we ended up buying about three slabs of aluminum for them to machine and kind of get it right. Well, so we wanted to figure out how to differentiate between these calls, but we wanted them to kind of look the same, and we couldn't afford to buy another slab of aluminum and make an entirely new mold. And so we kind of racked our brain and brainstormed and started asking around, and Wes came up with this brilliant idea that on the bottom third of the insert, basically the exhaust end where you would hold the call with your hand, he said, Spence, if we machined away, you know, if we took the mold apart, put it in a mill, and we machined away some of that material, it would make the outside diameter of the insert fatter. And he said, if we left about a quarter of an inch between where we machined and where the cork tab is, where it connects into the barrel, if we left that alone and didn't machine it, then it would be a smaller diameter and the exhaust would be a bigger diameter. And he said, we could build an aluminum band that we could slide over the top of the insert and it would basically create a seat. And he said, And he said, then we could just mark the aluminum band to be whatever we wanted. And we could, you know, one could say original and one could say 40 Colt 45 and one could say Easy Bark. And then we got to, so we kind of got to talking about that. And then Wes goes, better yet, what if we color coordinated them? And I was like, brilliant, you know, brilliant idea. So we started thinking about what colors we could do. And we decided that gold was kind of the gold standard and it was our logo. And so the original we decided would be like a yellowish gold color. And we decided that the Easy Bark, because it was easy, should be green, because green's kind of the universal color of Easy Street, right? And that left us with some other primary colors. There weren't many to choose from because we're talking about anodizing aluminum. And so we had to choose between like blue and red and orange and maybe purple and something else. So we eliminated purple, black, and like a gray. We eliminated black because it was just blend in. It wouldn't stand out. And we eliminated red because to me, red was kind of, there was something special about red. I wanted to save red to do something with someday. I didn't know what, but, and we did, obviously purple was, you know, like not very masculine color. So we get rid of it. So we picked blue for the Colt 45. And so with some brainstorming, and we can end right here, but with some brainstorming, we took one insert mold, one barrel mold, we modified the insert mold, and we came out with three products from one injection mold. Because the 45 was a modified version of the original, right? So I was hand cutting the ends of those tone boards. And then the Easy Bark was a different gut altogether, but it wasn't, it didn't come out of the same mold. So we only had one injection mold, but now we had three products. I guess that's what I'm saying.
I'm really curious to what happened to Easy Bark. If it sold that well, I mean, that's all I've been thinking about. Why did you stop? You don't have to tell the whole story, but
there's some details that I'd rather not discuss. But the short answer is, I was buying those tone boards, the molded tone board that went in the Easy Bark. I was buying those from another call maker, and I found out after a while of selling them that call maker had copied them from another, literally took somebody else's molded tone boards and sent them overseas and had them injection mold built for them. And I felt like that wasn't right, and I just didn't want to be a part of it. And so we just pulled that product altogether. That's the main reason. The secondary reason was that we came out with an easy to blow call. The first one we came out with was called the Hybrid, and it was an all acrylic call, that used a single 10 mil reed. And it was actually a lot easier to blow than the Easy Bark. And so it was difficult for people to understand why they needed a molded Easy Bark and $120 acrylic easy to blow call. And so it just kind of, those two factors together made it a really easy decision to, hey, let's just eliminate the Easy Bark. If somebody wants an easy to blow cut down, we'll give them the Hybrid. The Hybrid's acrylic. It's got a lot of other selling points. It's pretty. It's, you know, it comes in pearl acrylic colors, all the blah, blah, blah. And on top of it, I really don't want to get into the drama between callmaker A, who stole callmaker B's tone board, and now callmaker A is selling me those tone boards. And so kind of indirectly, that makes me stealing callmaker B's tone boards, even though I didn't have any idea that I was using somebody else's tone board. And so it was a win-win to just get out of that, you know?
Oh, yeah. Understand that.
I guess to kind of, the question you asked was, how did we go to mass produce it? And I wouldn't call anything we were doing mass producing. We're still a small company. I mean, there's only a couple of us that work there and every day. And I mean, it's not like we're, I'm not R&D. I'm not Echo. I'm not one of the big boys. I mean, we're still very modest and work our butts off for, you know, to get calls to people's doors. I mean, so there was still a lot of labor. We were just able to eliminate some of the big chunks of labor. I know the last thing I was going to say, I started to say earlier about the punch. The main way, Rocky, for probably from, say, 2000. So my buddy Wes left. He was my business partner, helped me build the mold. He was the engineer behind all that. He took the things that I built by hand and he turned them into a production. You know, he designed the mold. He designed the stuff. Okay. And he sourced a lot of that stuff. But he left in 2012. And when he left because he got hired by a big company out of Chicago called Medline. And, I mean, Wes hit a grand slam. He's a great guy. Wes is very intelligent and has just made an awesome career for himself in medical device manufacturing. But when Wes left in 2012, I didn't have any help. I mean, at that point in time, me and Wes would get together basically 3 or 4 nights a week after we got our kids in bed. You know, Wes would drive to Somerville and he would meet me in my garage and we would build calls together. And we did that. Some nights we'd build till midnight. Some nights we'd just build 2 or 3 hours. And some nights we'd stay up all night long. But we'd build calls. Well, when Wes left, it was just me. And I couldn't get as much done by myself as what two people could do. And I couldn't really hire somebody just in my garage at nighttime, you know? I mean, you don't really want your wife sitting on the couch while Joe Blow is out there in the garage tinkering with duck calls. But I did hire a guy. His name was Alex DeShazzo, and he actually works at the clinic for me now. He's one of the best technicians that I've got at the clinic, and he's a big, strong guy, and he can blow the snot out of a duck call. And he was the first guy that I had that could blow a call well enough to tune them. And so Alex would come, sometimes he would come during the day while I was at work. Sometimes he would come at night and work with me. Sometimes he'd come in the afternoon and tune calls for a few hours and then leave and go eat dinner and come back after I got done with dinner and stay with me for a while. But Alex helped me there for a couple of years, big time. But the main way that we were able to survive, say from 2012 to about 2015 or 16, the main way is every summer for maybe a week, sometimes it lasted 10 days. There were a couple people that would come and stay at my house and we would literally have like duck call camp and they would help me do stuff. One of them's name is Tyler Green and he doesn't comment a bunch on stuff. I don't know if he'll listen to it or not, this or not, but his nickname is Chirpy. But Tyler, for 2 or 3 summers in a row, he was in college, would come to my house. He'd sleep on the couch upstairs or in the extra bedroom. And we would work dark to dark. And we'd knock out a whole bunch of calls. And Tyler would punch thousands of reads. And there were other people that did that. Hardy Wiggins did that one summer. Actually, one summer, Shelby Anderson and Brent Wilkinson, when Shelby was kind of getting Goose Reapers fired up, he needed some work in the summertime, him and Brent, and so they jumped in the car and they drove and they worked for a week. And I'm leaving out some names, but literally, so what I would do is like I would try to sell to these stores in the late springtime, May, June time frame. April, May, June time frame right through there and get catalog space lined out and my product offering. And then I would get as many of the raw parts as I could get made, both acrylic parts, the swamp foxes and stuff, and the molded parts. But I'd get as many raw parts as I could, and I'd get as many people as I could, friends and people that wanted to work for a week, you know, and I'd feed them and put them up at the house, let them crash, and they'd work for, you know, nickels. And we'd literally just try to build as much inventory as we could build for a week. And there were several years there where we built enough inventory that would, like, get me to Christmas time, or get me well into duck season, and allow me to kind of keep up. And it always, the summertime just gave me the opportunity to kind of get ahead enough to where I could keep up. Me and Alex could keep up the rest of the year. And, I mean, I'm not the duck commander. I'm not R&T, but when I look back on how did we get to where we are today, that's like one of the things, one of the first things I think is there's no way I would have ever gotten this much done. If I didn't have people that were willing to come stay in my home and help me build dang duck, you know, pieces of plastic, put them together and polish them and sand them and punch reeds and just do grunt work. And, they needed a little bit of money, but they did it because they were just good friends. And I mean, I could rattle off Torrent, my buddy Torrent. He used to love to ride his motorcycle out and he'd hang out with me and Wes or me and Alex at nighttime, depending on who was around. I used to get texts from Torrent, you know, every afternoon about 4 o'clock. Are y'all going to work tonight? You know, yes or no. Torrent ride his motorcycle out to Somerville, and he'd pull up, and Torrent stay till midnight. He didn't have any kids. And you know, my buddy Derek, and I mean, I could just rattle off just gobs and gobs of names of people that some of them would work one night, some of them would work one night a week, some of them would work for a week straight. They just, you know, all different ways and different, we just figured out ways to do it. And I mean, for a little while, I had a couple people that would help me tune them, and I'd send them calls. I'd send them a whole box full of inserts and reeds and corks, and they'd tune them and send them back, and I'd blow through them and pick the ones that were good and the ones that weren't. I'd set them aside and then I'd tune them myself. But you know, all that kind of pitching in just lightened the workload for me and gave me the opportunity to kind of get my feet underneath me a little bit better. And, I mean, how do you repay people for that? How do you thank people for that? I mean, it's just, you can tell them thank you till you're blue in the face, but I mean, sometimes I look around at like where my business is right now. I'm just really grateful. It's kind of like you're just speechless. It's like, dang, you know, couldn't have built this by myself. Anyways.
I think you have two groups of people that come from that. There's a small minority that are a little bit of jealous of you. Yeah, I helped him build that. Then you have a large majority that are very proud of you. And, you know, and especially in moments like this, they're like, man, yep, we did it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know of anybody that helped that is in the jealous camp. I really don't. If they are and they're listening, I sure hope they pick up the telephone, call me and tell me that they would like some more recognition or something. I don't know. I mean, because that's certainly not what. I mean, I certainly don't want to be a. I don't want to be the kind of person that, you know, forgets the people that help you out and the people that were there when nobody else was. I think that I honestly think that at the end of the day, you could ask, I could give you a list of those people and that you could ask every one of them. And I think at the end of the day, every one of those people is in the camp of, that you said of really proud that they helped with that. I mean, I know that my closest friends are, and they love to, I mean, just like look at, I think it's one of the most fun things about what we've done is those guys know that I'm not, you know, I don't make a lot of money off the call company. I've put all the money back into the call company and kind of kept it growing. And I mean, just look at our booth at NWTF. Look how many people this year we took 12 couples to NWTF, 12 couples, husbands and wives. And then another 7 or 8 single guys. And I mean, those people came just because they want to hang out. They want to help. And man, every one of those people did something at NWTF that helped. I mean, whether they helped set up, whether they helped tear down, whether they stood there and demonstrated how to use a call, or, you know, showed what was different about this one over this one, or yelped on a mouth call. Every one of those people did something. There's literally not one person out of that whole group, you know, 12 couples. So that's 12 guys and maybe 6 or 7 single guys. You're talking about like 18 people who came up there for nothing, just to hang out, just to kind of promote the brand. People that, you know, those are friends. And I think it's fun because going to something like that, man, it gives you a chance to step back from real life and go to dinner with a bunch of good folks and meet a bunch of other people in the industry and get a fun shirt. Like, those guys love that. I love that. I look forward to it all year. And by building the call company and building the brand and kind of all this stuff, I guess what I'm saying is that the call company has afforded us some fun opportunities like that to just go and be together and be with customers and all that. And there's, I feel like all the people who have helped us get to where we are today, all of them have directly or indirectly benefited from events like NWTF and other trade shows and just stuff that's fun, you know, whether it's duck camp or whatever, or trips that we, you know, road trips. And so I don't know, that's kind of been one of my favorite things about it, is that the call company has really brought people together and made friendships that will last a lifetime. And, you know, that's all been fun. I'm just rambling now.
Next week, social media, the web series. We spent a little bit of time talking about the web series because I want to really go in depth about how you and Dylan developed that thing. I want to spend some time talking about that. And just like I said before we started this today, I was telling you, you kind of utilize social media in ways that nobody had used it before, when, you know, in the early stages of the call company. I want to talk about that next week. But we are out of time. Thank you again, bud. I enjoyed it. I want to thank all of you that listened to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.